Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. This is Firoz Manji. Welcome to the monthly broadcast from Daraja Press in collaboration with Amanda Radio. Thank you for joining us today. Recently, Professor Brian Mukande, Senior Research Fellow from the School of Languages and Cultures at the University of Queensland, Australia, visited Ottawa and gave lectures at Carleton University, Canada, and gave a number of seminars in Montreal as well. He has background in medicine, a physician, a doctor who trained in Harare, Zimbabwe, and has spent many years working in public hospitals there. He has migrated from being a physician to turning his mind and his focus to philosophy. He's today recognized as one of the emerging African philosophers and is currently working on a book about the Kenyan author and thinker Ngugi wa Thiong'o. I took the opportunity of his visit to talk to him about his reflections about his own work, as well as on his thinking on Ngugi wa Thiong'o. Brian, thanks very much for joining us today. It's a real pleasure to have had an opportunity to spend some time with you, and also to have had the privilege of listening to you and participating in a number of lectures that you've given at in Ottawa at Carleton University.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a joy to be here.
Oh, that's great. Great. You trained as a physician, as a medical practitioner in Zimbabwe. And, you know, you told us about how you spent many years working and seeing the conditions of a deteriorating health system and so on. And you are now recognized by many as one of the great thinkers, the great philosophers emerging. And it would be really interesting to know, why philosophy?
Wow, that's very, very, very kind. Thank you. You know, I wonder if one of the reasons why philosophy takes on a kind of resonance is because the stereotypical way, you know, like there's a general way of understanding philosophy as your head's in the cloud and being concerned with things that are esoteric and being removed a little bit from the day-to-day concerns of people working to make a living and to build the world, right? And actually, interestingly, Hannah Arendt kind of describes this. She blames it all on Plato, which I think is a little bit simplistic, but she recognizes this phenomenon, which I think in large part is why she wants to understand herself as a political theorist as opposed to a political philosopher, because she wants to say that my head isn't in the clouds, I am concerned with things in the world. I don't accept the, you know, like I agree that a lot of people take that approach to philosophy, right? But I think there are lots of other models of philosophy. So when I think about my philosophical practice, the two things that come immediately to mind is being like this young child who was allowed to stay in the room where the grown-ups were discussing life, the universe, and everything else, so long as I kept quiet. I didn't bother anyone to remind them that I was there.
Yeah.
And this practice of hearing these young adults who were invested in this world, who were thinking about this young nation, thinking about what it could become, and what the dangers were, and just going back and forth and thinking together and discussing and analyzing. This kind of like all of that's part of like the happiest memories of my childhood. And on the other extreme, like years later, when economically, socially, and politically things fell apart in Zimbabwe, when the health system like was buckling under the weight of an HIV and AIDS pandemic in a context where there weren't the sorts of resources that have been thrown at health systems in the West in the face of COVID, for example. Seeing people, you know, physically deteriorating, you know, attending to death, seeing the impacts of poverty, you know, of material deprivation, of unequal income distribution and wealth distribution, and just seeing what that does, what that did to people's well-being, to their health, to their bodies. I think I just came to a point where I became convinced that the difficulties and the pain and the suffering of people was tied to the ideas that were in place about how society ought to be organized, what it ought to look like, what the priorities ought to be, and also the shrinking of a space for deliberation and thinking collectively. And so for me, philosophy is an institutionally supported space where there are potential resources available to collectively grapple with the things that ail the world that we currently live in.
So is this another way of putting the old cliche that the point is not to change the world, the point to study the world, but to change it?
Absolutely. And, you know, the fact that, yes, Marx's 11th thesis, before back, kind of the fact that it needs saying and needs reiterating is an indictment, right? But yeah, I think the point is to change the world. And again, like for Marx, it's like, yeah, the problem with the philosophers is, and he's right, you know, but I think what people don't recognize is they think that he's like, but we, and I think they think that he's discarding all the philosophy and all philosophers. I think what he's saying is the philosophers ought to take a leaf from out of our book. I think what he's ultimately saying is like there's an idealist approach and conception to philosophy, which doesn't connect, isn't anchored in the material struggles of people of flesh and bone. And yeah, we have no time for that. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're interested in is deep thought and reflection and rigorous thought and reflection and philosophical thought that emerges from the material realities in which people, but particularly the most disenfranchised, the most marginalized people, you know, a philosophical program that emerges from that material reality, that's what we should be about.
So what has been your primary focus in moving into philosophy?
It's a really great question. And it hasn't been a straight line. It's been very tortuous. Initially, I think there was this desire just to flee all things medicine and health. And I'm not sure why exactly. But initially, I thought, like, I'd just stay away and I'd do something different. I found myself in Australia. And given where I was, the expertise around and what was available, the closest I thought I could get to, you know, like a project that would be legitimate, that'd be seen as legitimate in my philosophy department, but that was in some way connected to the people I was most concerned about. For some reason, I picked on Jacques Derrida, you know, which, yeah. I have a difficult relationship with Derrida. But for some reason, I picked Derrida, and I think it was the connection with Algeria. And also, you know, Jacques Derrida, born Jackie Derrida, was 20 years old when he left Algeria.
Mm.
You know, even though he's become known as this kind of prominent figure of French philosophy, you know, I think it's Christopher Wise, like, makes this case, like, Derrida is an African, you know. He made interesting decisions about his identity and how he'd be received and who he'd be in conversation with. But I think what drew me to him was the recognition that this is a fellow kind of African who similarly left the continent around the, you know, in his 20s, think he might have been 19 at the time, but more or less the same, and was trying to make sense of the world from his vantage.
Mm.
Now, I think all the stuff about play, again, kind of further betrays his own kind of flight and removal from where he came from. And over time, I just got to a point where it just became a bit frustrating. And I turned to the work of Frantz Fanon. And, you know, in terms of my kind of the theoretical aspects, or, you know, something like my philosophical genealogy, Derrida and Fanon particularly, he's got this wonderful line where he's thinking about Hegel's kind of dialectic of consciousness, how Hegel understands sociology to come into being. And he's like, look, Hegel thinks that this is about mutual recognition. And that might be the case, but in the colony, the master doesn't want recognition, they want labor. And that was like a big hook for me. And thinking about social organization and how we get the kind of world we have.
Right, but the master needs the slave to be recognized as a master.
Absolutely.
And there is that codependent. So what other philosophers, African philosophers, have influenced you? I mean, Fanon, obviously, yeah. And Derrida.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, there's a list of contemporary African philosophers whose work has been point of departure for me, right? You know, like Pauline Ntonji, Mokobe Ramose, Kwasi Wiredu, Nkiru Nsegu, you know, Kwame Jeche, his work's been interesting.
Seth Yotu?
Yes, his book on Fanon, with all of the respect to all of the other work that's been done on Fanon, I think that is the finest text on Fanon that's, you know, like, incredibly influential.
But also very hard work to go through, because he's very insightful and opens up a way of looking at Fanon that I think has often been missed.
Absolutely. And you know, like, I think one of the things we suffer from in our context is the professionalization of philosophy means that a text like that is unlikely to be read as much and just by the general public, right? And I think there's more of them now, but in a study circle, in a group where people are reading collectively, I can see people reading something like Lewis Gordon's What Fanon Said, which is a really, really, really great, faithful but accessible introduction to Fanon's work. I can see someone reading, you know, a group reading Alice Chekri's kind of The Life of Fanon, you know, and I can see kind of over time the group getting to a place of taking on Fanon's dialectic of experience in ways that are, you know, maybe slower than the pace at which they read those other works, but in ways that are really productive, right? So yes, it's difficult and it's complex. And it's also unpopular by virtue of just how materialistic it is, right? Like, I think, I don't know if part of it is, you know, things are difficult and there is kind of just this impulse to take flight away from the difficulties of our material reality. I don't know how much of it. Amon Towns has a wonderful book on the philosophy of media. And he makes this point that the protests around the Vietnam War, having to do with the different kinds of media that different generations have been socialized into, and jumping off of that, I wonder if the fact of a generation socialized on social media makes a text that's so material seem even more foreign or alien or something. But for whatever reason, I find that there is a kind of a tendency and a movement in around theory in general, including philosophy, to kind of turn away from substantive things and kind of reify them and turn them into like the, you know, like vaporize them and focus on more kind of like esoteric, far away versions of the same things.
So in your view, how relevant is Fanon today? I mean, he's a 20th century philosopher, writer.
Extremely so, and also not in some interesting ways. You know, I think there were people who read Wretched of the Earth in a kind of programmatic manner, given that time and that place, and rightfully so. And the world has moved on since then, right? You know, I find that in philosophy departments, Fanon's Black and White Masks is, you know, people leap upon it because it's a way of diversifying the curriculum without straying too far away from Sartre, Beauvoir, and Merleau-Ponty. It is, you know. The same people won't read A Dying Colonialism, they won't read Towards an African Revolution, won't read the psychiatric writings. And so I think in the sense, there's this weird paradox where the bits of Fanon that there's the most attention given to today, I suspect those are probably the least relevant for our time today.
Yeah.
The Fanon who's thinking about what does just care look like? You know, what ought to be the treatment goals of those who seem to the person giving that treatment as deviant from social norms? How ought that be conducted? You know, what's the relationship, what's the place of discipline in healthcare provision?
But isn't the core of Fanon about the struggle of the damned de la terre to reclaim their humanity, to actually invent what it means to be human? And it's that attempt to dehumanize people that was the core of the colonial enterprise, and I would argue even of the neo-colonial enterprise.
Absolutely, except I think we miss his entry point. So I think you're absolutely right. But you know, his entry point is as a medical student and then a doctor. And it's before that, kind of, you know, he gets there because he's, you know, got some medal fighting in the Second World War, right? But then he's in school, he's studying medicine, and there's this thing where the rhetoric of pushing back and fighting against one's dehumanization is very, very prevalent. And again, almost abstract, right? And so everything is like about, can be about like not recognizing my humanity, wanting to dehumanize me, this, that, and the other, right? Including from people while suffering harms, people with kinds of social security and safety nets and capital that is largely protective, right? And if we're talking at the level of my potential dehumanization by another, and here I'm critical even of people like Emmanuel Levinas, whose ethical theory where the other is infinite, but then all of the every other is infinite in exactly the same way, in a weird kind of way, because they're similarly unknowable and infinite. That kind of abstraction means that that particular person who is homeless and has these particular social or medical problems, that person and the harms that society brings upon them and which all of us may be complicit in, that's not the focus. The focus can end up being on this kind of, you know, abstract, there's the humanization which must be humanized, right? So les damnés are particular. And it's a collective of a particular, but like, you know, and there's a particular point of entry. And so I'm not saying that it's, you know, we shouldn't think in terms of classes, I absolutely am, or in, you know, collective groups, but just a recognition that it's easy to think of dehumanization as an abstract project. And I think that's unhelpful. Or, and I think this is for Fanon. Fanon's like, how did that person over there end up in that situation?
Hmm.
those social structures, those economic arrangements, those political processes, you know, that institutional arrangement, even in this hospital, these are the things that make this particular person prone in this way. And then he builds from that, right? And so, yes, ultimately what Fanon says is we need to create anew. We need to create a different society. We need to turn over a new leaf, you know. And we need to do that because these current institutional arrangements lead to that specific harm in that hospital, that specific harm in that street corner, that specific harm in that school. And the challenge is to not turn a blind eye to the specific, because when we do, I think there's a danger that there's a danger of all kinds of perversions under the guise of an emancipatory project when we lose sight of the particular.
Right. You are listening to a Dharaja Press curated edition of Amandla on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Let's move on to the work that you're currently doing. You've focused your attention on the writings of Ngugi wa Thiong'o, a Kenyan novelist, writer, thinker. So what's your view about Ngugi? I mean, you know, the surprise, I think, in many quarters was, why has Ngugi not been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, Nobel Prize for Literature? What's your view on that?
Because I kind of feel like this bit is like the twist at the end of this book that's slowly being written. So I'm going to misbehave and talk around as opposed to, this is very uncharacteristic of me. I like to responsibly jump headfirst into things. But can I just say about Ngugi initially? I think that he is such an important figure. I think his work is so incredibly important. And I think there is the sadness. I have the sadness about, you know, so into a group of PhD students in Montreal not so long ago and asking what folks were reading. So, you know, the part of a reading group. And they named all of these very popular, very recent texts, right? Which was great. But I think, I'm not sure that anything that they named went back further than 10, 20 years ago at most, right? And there's this thing where, you know, I think the kinds of struggles that Ngugi witnessed and participated in and contributed to, while different to the struggles of the moment, so much could be learned from, you know, and there's so much to be gained from thinking in tandem and thinking alongside him. This person who kind of goes to school during the emergency period in Kenya, who witnesses and thinks about this kind of moment of political transfer of power from the British to a Kenyan government, who spent some time in Uganda, Makerere, who spent some time in Leeds thinking, who's imprisoned in Kenya, who becomes essentially an exile thereafter. And, you know, the one time he comes back, him and his, you know, wife are like assaulted, who has a complicated relationship with the government, who has this kind of both, I would say, a Kikuyu nationalist and Pan-African kind of bearing. And there's this difficult dance between the two. When all of the works, the literary and the critical, that he has written, kind of grappling and trying to make sense of all of that, when they're reduced to what I think is often like a misreading of the river between, in the same way that people often, I think, misread what Achebe was trying to do with Things Fall Apart, or it's reduced to the title of one of his critical work, Decolonizing the Mind.
Mm.
It's like having this treasure trove in front of us and not particularly engaging it. And, you know, he's not unique in this sense, right? Like, I know you're a huge exception to this, but, you know, Cabral tends not to be kind of engaged in the ways that people should engage him. Like, James tends not to be engaged in ways that people should engage him. You know, I mean, Bessie Head is a really important figure for me. And while there was a moment of popularity a while back, you know, that seems to have waned, you know, C.L.R. James, you know, and kind of given my interest in Hegel when I was doing my PhD, I'm still like really sad that there weren't people in my department who were familiar with C.L.R. James's work who would have said, hey, have you read Notes on Dialectics? Like, you know.
Mm.
So there are all these works around, there are all these amazing thinkers around. But there seems to be this generational gap. And I think one of the reasons why I'm really motivated to engage Boogie's work is to try and bridge that gap.
But you mentioned, Fanon,
yeah,
C.L.R. James, Cabral, etc. To what extent has Boogie been influenced by those thinkers?
Yeah, so you're very cleverly kind of hinted at a kind of genealogy, right? And like a particular kind of like Marxist lineage. And yes, like I think, you know, like Ngugi's really clear about the ways in which Marx and Marx a lot, you know, and a lot of his reading of Marx kind of entry point being kind of Fanon, you know, Fanon's influence. He said, like, you know, C.L.R. James is the Black Jacobins, like, you know, he said just how critical text that is. I don't know. Like, you know, but George Lamming, like, again, like, really, really, really big influence on him.
Mm-hmm.
And the similarities with Cabral is a kind of an investment in the rural, an investment in the peasantry, in the agricultural, an investment in the kinds of everyday poor folks whose livelihoods are tied to their labor and their kind of like attempts to cultivate and bring life out of the earth. And more often than not, in our context, I think to the degree that there's interest in the quote unquote developing world tends to be urban rather than rural. When it's of kind of working class and poor folks, there's a weird kind of fetishistic almost, yeah, fetishization, you know, of that. And when it's not that, it's a kind of glorification of the middle classes on their path to developing into becoming like man in Sylvia Winter's terms, right? Becoming kind of these middle class types. And I, you know, I think one of the things that's remarkable about Boogie is despite his own trajectory and his own over time increasing distance from that constituency, there's been a chosen desire to identify with those people. You know, there's been a chosen desire to identify with those who Fanon described as the damned of the earth. Yeah.
So, but if we talk about Gorky, of course, mm-hmm. what immediately comes to mind is his writings and commentary as well as practice of language.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is a very central part of Gorky, certainly in the last 20 years, 30 years. It has been one of his core issues that he's tried to elaborate.
And you know, like, it's funny, and again, like, decolonizing the mind, people often invoke, and sometimes they'll know, and others they won't, that this is where he kind of announces his departure from English as the language he's going to write in, right? I struggle with that. I have an ambivalent relationship. Like, I struggle, I'm still thinking through, but, like, I struggle with the focus on language in that regard. And what I mean is, so the question of identity is a vexed one, and a lot of my work goes into the idea of identity. You know, in Ghana's first constitution, Kwame Nkrumah, like, had this idea written into it that progressively the nation state of Ghana would be dissolved into this kind of, like, Pan-African entity, right? And for me, this kind of, like, well, one, you know, one of the things that's remarkable about that is a disinvestment in a bounded territory and in boundaries and borders. And an outward lookingness and an outward focus. You know, Ngugi has, like, this kind of idea of these different spheres where we belong. There's this concentric relationship where there's the family and there's the kind of language group or group of some sort, and then there's the nation, and then there's the Pan-African Hall, right? That is a contingent normative ideal. And by that, I mean, it's contingent, not necessary. It's not a priori. It's an image of the world, a conception of identity that one can choose, but you didn't have to choose. And it's not as though, like, it's a law of nature that that must be so, right? So it's not the case that we have to understand ourselves in these ways. And in fact, understanding ourselves in these ways, I would argue, kind of takes shape through and in the aftermath of colonialism. And Kiran Zogu's book, Family Matters, she makes this point profoundly, you know, that, and in her case, it's like, you know, the heteronormative family structure is a colonial imposition on Igbo people, where before they were matrilineal, patrilineal, women-headed, women, all sorts of family structures that existed prior. And similarly, this idea that I am Shona, then Zimbabwean, or in Ngugi's case, I am Kikuyu, then Kenyan, then African, is a chosen model. And a chosen model where there are other models out there to choose from, or if we go the Fanonian route, let's create a new, let's turn over a new leaf. That's the first thing. The second thing is there is a difference between an affirmation of one's linguistic identity when one belongs to a linguistic minority and an affirmation of a linguistic identity when one belongs to the hegemonic linguistic group. Now, you can argue, well, in Kenya, that would be the English, it would be English as opposed to Kikuyu, but I think it's arguable, and the fact that it's arguable means that the very worst finding, let's call Kikuyu the counter-hegemonic. Still, in the same way that German that what might be read as German nationalism might give people with a history of the 40s pause, an assertion of linguistic pride from the hegemonic or counter-hegemonic group isn't politically inert, right? Like, there is political work that it does, and there's political work that it does that puts linguistic minorities that makes their situation more precarious. Yeah. And then the third thing is, in terms of what it means to be African, there are many groups who don't necessarily speak an indigenous African language, who I think my normative claim is who have full claim to Africanness, to participate in Africanness, whatever that is. There are, you know, there are kind of descendants of the enslaved in places like North America or the Caribbean who speak English or French or Spanish, who the idea that if we make kind of linguistic proficiency and linguistic proficiency of a particular indigenous African language the mark of Africanity. And I'm not arguing that that's what Ngugi does, but I think it's a hop, skip, and a jump from his position to that. I think we'd all recognize that as absurd. And then there's other groups, right? Like kind of Africans of South Asian descent, you know, Africans who trace their heritage to the Arabian Peninsula. Those Berbers. And I imagine there'll be somebody listening who'll be like, and what about white South Africans? And I'm like, yeah, that's a really good question, you know? I don't know.
To be able to at least challenge the idea that it is, one doesn't have to use a colonial language to give expression to ideas, to give expression to history, to give expression to articulating and even of articulating mathematics, philosophy, etc. And in that sense, it's an important step. But why Kikuyu? Why not Swahili, for example?
And you see, and that's the point, right? Like, you know, so I mean, like, I read Nietzsche as well, right? And there are many, 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 many really troubling groups who want to repurpose what Nietzsche said for their own ends, which are unjust to Nietzsche. And same thing, right? You can say, like, what other people might do with Ngugi's ideas isn't, that's not something you should hold against Ngugi. And I agree. I agree completely. I'm not being dismissive of the person, you know. I'm kind of grappling with an idea and the implications of that idea. And yes, we live in a world in which if you publish an article in French or Spanish or Mandarin, the global political economy of ideas is such that those ideas don't carry the same weight as if you did in English. And if that's true of English and Spanish and Mandarin, how much truer is it of Kikuyu or Luo or, you know, or Igbo, you know, but if it's true of those, and then, and you know, then there's other kind of like languages with smaller linguistic communities on the continent and others with even smaller linguistic communities on the continent and so on and so forth. So that argument could be made without necessarily, you know, so yes, that's a valid argument. But there is something when you're in Kenya about declaring a preference for Kikuyu. And Ngugi also, you know, like he makes it clear that in his work, that there was a period of having to learn to write in Kikuyu, right? If you're going to make that, if you're going to prize linguistic diversity and divestment from English, and you're in a Kenyan context, again, I don't think that the option for Kikuyu is politically inert. You know, I think there are significant kind of consequences of that. And people, and especially where there is a regional lingua franca like Swahili. Now, someone might say, well, look, Ngugi's mother tongue is Kikuyu, not Swahili, so it's just natural. And my response to that would be to say, that idea that one's natural language is one's mother tongue, that's another normative claim. You're saying that this ought to be the case where there is no a priori, no before the fact proof that actually that is how things should go. Like, so what happens is there, generally, by convention, children learn the languages of their parents, right? That doesn't mean that if a child moves or is moved or for whatever reason learns another language, that they've somehow been robbed of something, that somehow their identity has been taken away. The idea that there is a language that's natural to me, that's an ideology, it's not a statement of fact. And one of the things I think that we struggle with as a continent is an embrace of a kind of ethno-nationalism that has done more harm to us, I think, than many, many, many other things. So historically, going back, historians, I think, will mount and can mount strong cases for people take on the languages of the communities in which they find themselves, as opposed to people at all costs hold on to this thing that is called a mother tongue.
You are listening to a Dharaja Press curated edition of Amandla on CKUT 90.3 FM.
But that said, I mean, it's also true, isn't it, that under capitalism, and especially in its old age, its decadent period of neoliberalism, that there is a phenomenon worldwide of a disappearance of languages, and is not what Gogi has tried to do, is at least to reassert a basis for the reclamation of a language which could be in danger of disappearing.
I mean, look, by the time we're at a place where we're talking about Kikuyu disappearing, how many other, you know, by that stage it's late. It's like it's too late for, like, you know, by this point, I mean, so yes, the beauty and the wealth and the creativity and the dynamism in every single language, absolutely. Absolutely, right? The value of every single language, absolutely. Is it sad when any of them comes to a position where there are no more speakers of that language? Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. Should we invest in language policy? Absolutely. Should we offer instruction in a variety of languages? Absolutely. Which one, though? And you see, my problem, the thing that I'm struggling with, the thing that I'm pushing against, is the idea that as an individual, the language that I ought to be most invested in is my quote-unquote mother tongue. Why? You know, again, ideology as opposed to, and not just ideology, but ethno-nationalist ideology. Mm. An ideology that ties me to a particular ethnic community and the power structure surrounding that community, as opposed to tying myself and my identity to a different, perhaps even a larger project. So if you like, we could say, pick a language. Let's say that there is political and strategic import in getting children in South Africa to learn Swahili. So you know, schools will instruct you in Swahili, and you can learn any one of those other 11 languages at home. Or, I mean, what if we decide, I said global politics, I'm thinking I want to pick a language from somewhere, not in Africa, but and I'm thinking about the politics of whatever language I decide, and I'm thinking, like, is there something neutral? There's no such thing as neutrality. Vietnamese. Mm. Why don't we say, like, you know, like, there was a situation in an Australian school last year, where, I think it was last year, where the school had an immersion Vietnamese program. And then one day they woke up and they were like, ah, Vietnamese shouldn't be a global language. It isn't a global language. Let's make the immersion program Italian. Again, similar kind of ideology, right? It's like, why is Italian a global language, not Vietnamese? There's absolutely no reason to think that, you know. But similarly, there's no reason to think that children in Zimbabwe shouldn't be instructed in Vietnamese either. So, and this is one of the benefits of philosophy for me, right? It's the idea of conceptual clarity. So let's be clear about what we're arguing. If we're arguing the preservation of languages and languages that are endangered, if that's the argument, great. But in Kenya, then, the most endangered language, the least endangered language in Kenya is Kikuyu. It's not the most, right? So, okay, identify the least endangered language then. Or if we're like, no, we're not going to be utilitarian about it, we're going to be strategic, great. Pick some European language then. Oh no, the politics of that. But what I'm saying is, let's be clear about what we're arguing.
Sure. But okay, so what is the connection between language and emancipatory politics?
I like to make a distinction between the politics of a thing and the philosophical and the philosophy of a thing. Because the one is the politics of a thing has to do with calculation and calculus and the like. A philosophical analysis is kind of like grappling with what's actually happening with that. And those are slightly different things, right? I'm just going to make my task even harder by saying this. So, yeah, there's a problematic philosopher. He had a dalliance with Nazism, but his name is Heidegger. You can be a Nazi and be right about some things. And, you know, a broken clock is right twice a day, right? You know. So, but, you know, Heidegger said, like, and he wasn't actually a Nazi. I shouldn't have even gone down this road. But Heidegger said that language is the, what is it? Language is the home of being or something like that. And what I take from that is there's something, and something's putting it very, very, very inadequately. Like language potentially fosters and cultivates all sorts of social, aesthetic, and other kinds of ideas, maybe even. Yeah. So language is very, very, very significant and important, right? That thought. And philosophically, that's the only philosophical claim I'm comfortable of making right now, that language is of social and aesthetic import. Like it's significant and important, and particular, and language in its particularity. Having said, you know, like having kind of granted that, in terms of political struggle, then there's a question of calculation. Right, it's like, so what are our goals? And given our goals, what kind of deployment of language will help us achieve our goals? If the goal is a kind of concentration of power in the hands of a particular group with a particular kind of infrastructure, then a recourse to language can be incredibly helpful, right? The one thing I know about the Horn of Africa is that I don't understand the politics and the ethnopolitics of the Horn of Africa. But I am sure that when things heat up and get more hostile, investments in the varieties of languages there, it's probably more pronounced than when things are calmer and more peaceful, right? Because language is highly significant, I think your political goals and strategy will determine how you engage it. And I think what we can say is looking, you know, taking a look at people's pronouncements and deployments and policy around language gives you a really good insight into their political goals.
But aren't you, perhaps some might say, guilty of going back to our earlier conversation about philosophy and politics being separate?
Yes. Distinct, not separate. So my subsequent step after that would be to say, so now here's my kind of like norm, right? Andaye, in a wonderful book edited by Lisa Trotz titled The Point is to Change the World, has the best explication of identity politics I've ever read anywhere, where she's like, we can start with our sectoral interests. But so long as we're starting with our sectoral interest, and she's writing from the situation of a Guyana in which there is a community of people of African descent, a community of people of Indian descent, and there can be tensions and struggles and, you know, different kind of interests at play. And I was like, you know, given that, it makes sense to start from your particular sectoral interests. If that starting place, though, is just a means of organizing so that you can then go outwards and connect intersectorally, that's great. And that's an approach to identity politics, and that's a helpful one. right? But she's like, you know, but if you want to stay kind of insulated in the separate kind of like sectors, then, you know, this is a kind of identity politics from which no good can come, right? And so I would say, like, look, similarly, I am a Pan-Africanist with a expansive view of what that means, the non-insular view of what it means to be African. And my Pan-Africanism is a starting point because I think all of us, we people who are African, have the potential and the ability to change the world. So then the question is, what conception of language, what politics of language allows us to build collectively and to build collectively in such a way that we can intervene not just on each other's kind of situations internally, but intervene on a world that's lost its mind and that needs us to save it from itself, right? And given that ethnocentric linguistic politics will be the death knell of us all. So language is an incubator and is incredibly important. What sort of investments in language will foster a kind of our collective coming together? And I, you know, and that's what I'll be grappling with. So for me, part of what that means is not divesting from English and French and Portuguese, but thinking about ways of disseminating the creative additions, subtractions, remixes of those languages that happen in different places. You know, I love watching Black British kind of TV because of these Jamaicanisms and these Nigerianisms, you know, in that televisual stuff and in that music.
Well, it's like Sheng from the
exactly. Kenya. Exactly, right? Yeah. And the thing is, like, the beauty and the creativity was fostered by Sheng. How do we disseminate that? You know, how do we make it so that, you know, Nollywood
become universal?
Exactly, right? So Nollywood, for example, has facilitated, you know, the other day a friend of mine said something about a little girl or something. She said something and like something I ordinarily might not have understood, right? But that I understood by virtue of the dissemination of these Nigerianisms by way of Nollywood, right? Yeah. And so linguistic investment, like an investment in Kuyu, absolutely, an investment in Swahili, absolutely. But one whose starting point isn't these are mother tongues, but ones which are...
The starting point.
Yeah.
So that's quite a strong critique then of Gugi's approach.
Look, I mean, and in a sense, my model is Simon Gikandi's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book on Gugi, right? Where he both reverence is the wrong word, where like his appreciation and respect and admiration for Gugi is explicit, but at the same time, there are questions and challenges and critiques that he makes. And that's what it means to take somebody seriously. Like, you know, I take Gugi seriously as a scholar in the same way I take Fanon seriously, in the same way that I take Hegel seriously, in the same way that I take Plato seriously. Because I take Plato seriously, there's parts of the Republic which I think are genius and there are others which I think are terrifying and terrible, right? Because I take Hegel seriously, there are aspects of the phenomenology that I think are brilliant, and others I'm like, eh. And then there's others of his other work that I think like, eh. You know, but that's what it means to take a thinker seriously. To sing his praises and engage in hagiography is to disrespect him,
yeah.
Right? And so it's like, I think it's really important that others read his work for themselves and his ideas are more widely disseminated. That's how important and I think his work is, and seriously I take him. And exactly the same time, because I take him seriously, there are some ideas that he has that I, you know, vehemently disagree with.
So when do we expect to read your book?
This is a very good question. It's been good being here, having time to write. My aim is to have a complete manuscript, by the end of the year, hopefully before that. Also while at the same time grappling with, at the one hand, you don't want to be lazy, and you don't want to procrastinate. On the other hand, some things take time. And sometimes thinking is slow and difficult, and it takes time. The thinking has been slow and difficult, and it's taking time. But I'm hopeful that that'll be done before the end of the year. There'll be a full manuscript before the end of the year.
Well, I look forward to reading it and perhaps interviewing you again when I've had a further insight into your view about Bulgogi.
No, I've got to say, I've only ever had one kind of conversation with Ngugi, but he was incredibly generous. He was incredibly generous and incredibly warm and incredibly kind.
Yeah, no, he is. It's one of the remarkable things about him. But thank you for giving time for this discussion. I could sit here and talk all day with you on lots of other issues.
Thank you for joining us today on this monthly broadcast from Dharaja Press and Amandla Radio. The program was produced by Clara Swan Kennedy and, as always, supported by Gwen Shulman from Amandla Radio. I hope that you will join me again next month. Meanwhile, I send you love and best wishes. Thanks to Amira Kheir for permission to use her beautiful song, Samiri, otherwise known as Kindred Spirit, from her album Mystic Dance. حبيبتي يا توب احلي بحياتها اهاجر.